The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Let's go ahead and turn over to Revelation in chapter 12. The 12th chapter of Revelation. The sermon for today will be discussing, it will be the last sermon in a series. I can't say the final sermon because we will probably discuss this subject in future sermons, but this is the last one in a series that I had started a couple of months ago regarding the protection that God will afford to certain people during the end of the age. Now, the first sermon we had discussed when the Great Tribulation would begin, and because that's a cue to the time when God would begin to protect certain people. The second sermon discussed how people would actually be protected, that is, escape Great Tribulation. And the third sermon that we had last time I gave a sermon went over the scriptures indicating who God will protect during that period of time. Today's message will be regarding the purpose of protection, and it includes a measure of seclusion in this place that is described as a safe place, being in a wilderness. And so we began this series by reading a portion of Revelation 12, where a woman here is portrayed representing the church. And the illustration in this entire chapter gives us an abbreviated history of the church beginning in the first verse. And so that first verse speaks of this woman having a protective garment portrayed as the sun, the moon under her feet, a garland of 12 stars, which is basically a crown. And it moves in to give us a description of her having a child, crying out in labor. And I think this portrays not just the church now, it portrays Mary giving birth to Christ, who is the head of the church. And it's understood that this woman, as we go through the prophecy here, it's a portrayal of the church of God, who will be miraculously, or at least a portion of the church, miraculously taken to a place of safety called her place. And it says that she will be nourished there. Now in verse 6, it says that the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days, a specific number. And there are a few aspects of that number, and I won't go into all of it during this sermon because I'm going to focus just on what is important to the subject at hand. In verse 14, we had read in the first message in this series, and we'll read it again, that the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she may fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So something in this regard is interesting. If you go to the next chapter in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 13, it speaks of this dragon which is a portrayal of Satan, having great authority, giving that to the beast. And we understand that that is an evil empire at the end of the age that will be inspired and even empowered by the devil. And it talks about people worshiping the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? And of course, a person worships whatever it is that they obey. So this does not necessarily mean people will be bowing down in reverence and praying to the beast, although some likely will. But it is talking about people who are falling in line, saying, can't argue with that. Can't argue with that authority. Look at what this empire and this person who is heading that empire is doing. And so the beast portrays a world power that will be dominant over much of the earth at the end of the age. And this empire will be led by an individual that is referred to as the man of sin. And it says in verse 5 that this beast was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Now, obviously, any human being already has a mouth, and what it is talking about, this individual on this empire will be given great authority to speak great things. But this is not something given to it by God. This comes from the dragon giving the authority to the beast. Because the devil does have a measure of authority on this planet at this time. Only as God allows, of course, but that is the case. And so, when it speaks of these periods of time, we have now 42 months, 1,260 days, times time and half a time. And if you take the numbers 1,260 and divide it by 42, you can do it in your calculator later if you want, but most of you know where I'm going with this, you come up with the number 30. And so this relates to 42 months, having 30 days each in each of those months. And so that is the reckoning of a prophetic time frame. Now, I'm not going to go into how this prophetic time frame is concluded. Many of us are aware of how we have come to that conclusion. It is something that is the Church of God in general has known for some time now. A thorough study of Genesis chapter 7 and chapter 8 and those time frames mentioned there help us to understand how God has reckoned the number of days in a month in the past, being 30, and continue to estimate that time frame prophetically for the future. So if you divide 42 months, by the number 12, 12 months being in a year, you get 3.5 exactly, or 3.5. And of course, that's a time, 1 times 2, and half a time being 3.5. I'll try to put my finger up a halfway there. It's kind of hard. Let's turn over now to Daniel and chapter 7. We will come back to Revelation, but it won't be for a while. Daniel 7. Interestingly, in regards to this time frame, there are two other places in the Bible where a time, times, and half a time is stated, and they both are speaking prophetically of end time events in regards to this woman, a portrayal of the church. And the other places are in Daniel 7, also in Daniel 12, and I'm going to read both of those briefly. Daniel 7 and verse 25 says of this beast, again, speaking of the beast, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law, and then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. And this is relating to the persecution of some in the Church of God. In Daniel 12, if you just go over a page, maybe two, Daniel 12, in verse 7, and I'm going to read, well, the second portion, the second half of verse 7, where it talks about this man clothed in linen here, which is symbolic, and it says that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. So these references here do not speak of a portion of the church that is going to be protected. They speak of a portion of the church that will be persecuted. That is the description that we read about last week. We talked about that last week regarding who will be protected. And we saw that this woman, a portrayal of the church, portrayed in the poetic, prophetic writing by Solomon in Song of Solomon chapter 5 that she missed the boat, if you will, was not ready when Christ came, and she went out into the streets and she was severely beaten. So perhaps it would have been helpful to include those two scriptures in Daniel in that sermon last week, but now we do have it here to confirm the poetic and prophetic scenario of Song of Solomon. And so let's go all the way back to the New Testament and to Matthew 4 this time. Matthew in chapter 4. This leads us to be able to dive into the reason why some will be taken, protected, and nourished. Now, unlike most might think, it is my understanding that the reason for protection is not so that those people can avoid pain and suffering. Sure, perhaps that's a fringe benefit, but God does not enjoy violence and he does not enjoy sorrow, seeing people suffer, but it's not about saving our skin. Christ said that the flesh profits nothing. We know it's going to go away. However, the profit can be gained while in the flesh is something spiritual, which is why we have the spirit of man. And when the spirit of God merges with that spirit, a new creation begins within us. And so what can be gained while in the flesh is character. It is the integrity of an individual who reveres God. That is something that we can gain through God's grace, which is defined as his influence in our life and how we reflect that influence and what we do, how we live, and, of course, knowledge, the knowledge of God. So learning to endure and to be faithful is the only attribute that is going to be able to endure beyond the flesh. And for this reason, we can speculate as to why Christ will choose to take certain people to a place of safety. And while there are scriptures that do point to our conclusion, we must admit that it is a theory, that the nourishment that is spoken of in Revelation 12, that it refers to hands-on spiritual training, learning, instruction, conversation even, with the Messiah himself. Not coming to people as a spirit being, because no human being would be able to live in his presence, to see his face and live, but appearing to people as a fleshly being, just like he did to the apostles. And so Christ spent much time with the disciples, and he spent a lot of time with both men and women during his ministry. And so with this in mind, consider his first coming being born as a male child and then maturing as a wise young man. When Christ's official public ministry began, when he was finally ready to begin, after John the Baptist had prepared the way for him, Jesus worked with certain people. He worked with certain men and women, and he personally taught these individuals. Why? It was so they could assist him in building his church. And so could it be that Christ will continue this process by gathering specific individuals to be protected at the end of the age for the purpose of personal instruction? Now, we are aware of the number 7 representing completion, 7 days in a week. There are 7 high holy days a year. There are 7 weeks in the count to Pentecost and the year of release every 7 years, the count to the Jubilee, 7 sets of 7. It's over and over again in the scriptures. We are aware of this number that is used to represent completing something that God has ordained. So this theme is demonstrated throughout the Bible, and it can also be found within the period of time of Christ's earthly ministry. But how can we know how long Christ's ministry was from the moment that he began to openly preach? I mean, where in the Bible does it say that he would have a seven-year ministry? Well, we know Jesus began to preach after John the Baptist was imprisoned in Matthew, did I say 7, 4? Yeah, 4. Matthew 4, and we are going to read verses 12 through 17, where it says, "Now when Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he departed to Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea," or perhaps that's pronounced Capernaum, "by the sea, in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled, which is spoken by Isaiah the prophet, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea." Oh, I kicked this over down here. I guess I shouldn't have set it there. Here we go. It didn't spill. Okay. Let's see. "By the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And upon those who sat in the region in the shadow of death, light has dawned." So it's talking about the beginning of his public ministry, a light to those people in that area where it would begin. And then it says in verse 17, "From that time, Jesus began to preach and to say, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" A light, not to that just community, but to regions beyond. It would spread. It would shine all around that area eventually. But what time of year was this when the dawning of his ministry started? It's not certain. We don't know. I don't know of anybody that has a good idea. Just a guess. A guesstimate, I guess you would say. And if we understand what I'm about to go through right now, then we can guess as to what time of year that ministry began. In any case, something that we do know is that after the beginning of Christ's ministry, there were four observances of Passover before Christ was crucified. And that can be found in John 2 and verse 13 is the first one after he began his ministry, where it says, "Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." And then the next place is in Luke chapter 6 and verse 1, and that is a telling of the disciples going through a grain field and picking a few handfuls of grain. But Luke, when he tells of that event, he indicates that it happened after the second Sabbath. It happened on the second Sabbath after the first. And so the phrasing refers to the feast of Passover, because there are two and frequently three Sabbaths, if you include the weekly Sabbath, that occur during that feast. John 6 and verse 4 indicates a third, where it says, "Now the Passover of a feast of the Jews was near." And then in John 11 and verse 55, we have the fourth. And of course, all of the gospel accounts speak of that fourth famous, and it could even be said, perhaps in a way, an infamous Passover meal that Christ observed before his suffering and being marred more than any man and eventually being killed through crucifixion. Daniel chapter 9, I should have told you to put a ribbon there because I want to go back to Daniel for a moment. And so the time allotted for Christ's public ministry in the flesh appears to be incomplete. It's more than 3 years, but it's not 4 years. And I think it would be safe to say that it was 3.5 years. But we don't have to rely on assumption alone to come to this conclusion. The angel Gabriel had relayed a fascinating and to many a confusing prophecy to Daniel, and it's referred to as the 70 weeks prophecy, And I would like to dive deep into the 70 weeks prophecy. Not today, obviously. I need to spend some more time studying the subject. But for today, I want to consider an important aspect of those 70 weeks. In Daniel 9, in verse 24, 70 weeks are determined for your people, for your holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. And so it's likely that this portrays a period of time that from when the Jews were freed until Christ came. Now, therefore, understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. And the street shall be built again, and the wall, and even in troublesome times, this will happen. And after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Now here's what I really want to focus on in the next verse here, verse 27. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate. And it goes into, talks about the abomination of desolation, that Christ said it was an indicator of the beginning of the end of the age. And so there is a day for a year principle found in these weeks, and I'm going to be talking specifically about this week where he confirms a covenant with many. And then the day for a year principle is familiar to us when we consider Isaiah's prophecy of the final year of great tribulation, the year when the trumpet plagues and the bowl plagues will be poured out. And it's called in Isaiah 61 and verse 2, the acceptable year of the eternal and the day of vengeance of our God. And so it gives you the answer right there in one sentence, the year and the day. A day representing a year. And so what we have in Daniel 9 and verse 27 is an indicator that Christ would confirm the covenant with many during his ministry for a prophetic week. 7 days equivalent to 7 years. Now, Paul said in Romans 15 and verse 8, that Christ has become a servant to the circumcision for the truth of God to confirm the promises made to the fathers, the covenant, to confirm the covenant, in other words. And this means that his confirmation ministry, would take place over a period of 7 years. However, his crucifixion occurred in the first half of his ministry, and we just went over the number of Passovers. It wasn't 4 years before he was crucified, but it wasn't 3 years. It was somewhere in the middle, 3.5 years after it started. And it says here in Daniel that it was stopped in the middle of the week when he would bring an end to sacrifices and offerings. So it's talking about the animal sacrifices, the animal offerings, all of which represented Christ. In various ways, those things represent Christ. And so this stopped in the middle of a prophetic week. And so where is the other half of his ministry? Where can it be found to complete this week? Is there another 3.5 year period that is spoken of in the scriptures? There is. And we had read that at the beginning. It is talking about the 3.5 years of great tribulation, which includes the protection of certain individuals in a place where they will be nourished. Hopefully you're following me here. I know some people look a little confused, but I'm trying to really break it down in the most simplest way it can be presented. We had read in Revelation 12 and verse 6, you don't need to turn there, but as a reminder, we had read it already, that the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Divided by 30, 42 months. Divided by 12, 3.5 years. The woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So is it possible that this is going to be what completes the second half of Christ's earthly ministry when he will again appear to people in the flesh and he will give people personal instruction? Could it be that you or I, we might actually be able to have a conversation face-to-face with the Messiah? That's a wonderful thing to think about. A little frightening, I guess, in some respects, but I think more wonderful than frightening. Well, in order to fulfill a prophetic week, that is something that needs to occur. A prophetic 7 years found in the 7 days, and that instruction would again include conversation, teaching, parables, a variety of things. I mean, 3.5 years, that's a long time to be able to talk to somebody. The same period of time he was able to talk to the disciples and those men who became apostles. A lot could happen during that time. And of course, there is more evidence to support this theory. If you go to 1 Corinthians 9, or 1 Corinthians 10. A familiar scripture, even if you don't turn there, it's where the Apostle Paul pointed out that the events of ancient Israel's history foreshadowed things that Christians would experience. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11 that all these things happened to them, speaking of Israel, as examples, and they were written for our admonition, written for us, recorded for us, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Exodus 19, let's read a bit about that, just a bit. There's so much that could be covered in that principle of those things that they experienced from beginning to the end of their history as a nation, lessons that can be learned for us, given to us. And some of that, of course, begins when they had departed Egypt, or before they had departed Egypt. I mean, Israel was led out of Egypt, but it was only as a result of a variety of plagues that was brought upon that wicked nation. And those plagues reflect plagues that will be poured out, some coming through trumpets, some coming through Satan's wrath found in the seals, which starts Great Tribulation. Those are reflected by the plagues of Egypt. But the Great Tribulation plagues, of course, are going to be much more severe. They will be on a broader scale. They will be felt around the globe. However, Israel, we see what happened during those plagues. They were protected from most of them anyway, protected from those plagues, just as God will protect some during Great Tribulation. Now, after being led out of Egypt, God said of Israel in Exodus 19 and verse 4, he said, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." And then if you'd go over a page or two to Exodus 23 and verse 20, it says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared." So this is an example, as Paul said, for those upon whom the end of the ages has come. And because Israel walked out of Egypt and to this place that God had prepared, some think that people will walk to a place of protection. And of course, we had talked about that in the second sermon of this series. We can read that God symbolically bore Israel on eagle's wings. But when it comes to those people who will be protected at the end of the age, it says that God will give two wings of a great eagle to the woman, to the church. And it says she will fly into the wilderness. The book of Psalms, chapter 91, Psalm 91, has another witness in the scriptures that fits with this scenario. Psalm 91, and let's read the first 12 verses here. A beautiful psalm. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty, speaking of God as a refuge, a place for safety. I will say of the Eternal, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In Him I will trust. Surely He will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence, a plague. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day. Trials, tribulation, nor the pestilence that walks in the darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only look with your eyes and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Eternal, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For He shall give His angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Now, of course, there is some duality in this. Speaking of all of God's faithful people, those who trust in Him and are faithful to Him, also speaking of Christ and His walk in life. But it definitely applies to the woman that is spoken of in Revelation 12, and also Daniel. Let's go to Song of Solomon, chapter 4, if you'd go forward. In the last sermon, we had read a portion of the Song of Solomon that illustrates the common attitude among the wider Church of God today, this church at the end of the age. It speaks of a woman who made herself comfortable at home while she waits for her beloved to come for her. But when he does come, she is very content where she lay. She doesn't want to get up. She doesn't want to be discomfited by doing what it takes to open the door for him. Of course, it seems like a simple task, right? But that task portrays something. The attitude of the church, the wider church at the end of the age, that they don't really want to do what it takes to be able to have the door opened for Christ to come and retrieve them. And so what did Christ say to the last era of the Church of God, to this in this letter to Laodicea? In verse 20 of chapter 3 in the book of Revelation, it says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me." Now in Song of Solomon that we read last week, or the week before, is in the last sermon, the woman, we see she eventually does get up and open the door for her beloved, but he's gone. Where did he go? We read how she goes out to search for him in the streets of the city, where she is beaten in the streets and abused. Where can the beloved bridegroom be found? Well, if we look at the beginning of this part of the poetry here, the prophetic poetry, in Song of Solomon chapter 4 and verse 16, it says, "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits." And I kicked this thing over again. Well, I'm going to set it over here this time. Shouldn't even have brought it up here. My mistake. Trying to juggle too many things at once. In any case, it speaks of a garden here. And this garden portrays a place where the church will be nourished. It portrays even the church. And it's beckoning to the beloved to come and to partake of its pleasant fruits. And if we go on into the first verse here, which we read last time, "I have come to my garden." And this is a portrayal of Christ speaking. "I've come to my garden, my sister, my spouse, with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I've drunk my wine with my milk." And so Christ comes down to his garden, a symbolic reference here to the church. And it's referencing a church in a place of nourishment, this woman in a place where she can be nourished. And he as well benefits from this. And as a confirmation of this, verses to support this, Isaiah 5 and verse 7 is something good to have in your side notes here, where it says that the vineyard of the Eternal of Hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And who can be included in that, those categories? People of Israel, the people of Judah. Anybody who reveres God and keeps the commandments. Behold, an Israelite indeed. Abraham's seed are those who keep the commandments of God. It doesn't matter what your heritage is. And speaking as elders of the church, Paul had said in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verses 6 through 9, he said, "I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. And so neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God gives the increase. It is through his Spirit that we have fruits of the Spirit." And Paul said, "For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field." A place where things can grow. A garden, if you will. So where is Christ when the woman is persecuted? It speaks of her persecution in verse 7 of chapter 5 in the Song of Solomon. I don't need to read it, but that's where it's found. Where is he? Well, the story continues in the next chapter, chapter 6, where daughters of Jerusalem ask the woman, as she is searching for her beloved, they ask her, "Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with you?" In other words, he sounds great. Well, let's seek him together. Where is he? Let's go. But notice next that the woman, she knows where he has gone. That he's gone to a certain place, that is, but she does not know where that is or how she can get there. In verse 2, it says, "My beloved has gone to his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies." And that's something important and interesting to focus on. Feeding the flock in the garden, but also to gather lilies. Now, if you'd go back a page or two to Song of Solomon, chapter 2 and verse 1, this whole poem here, it includes this reference where it says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. The churches. Christ's love is like a lily among thorns. A blossoming flower among the churches. Something that is beautiful to behold and special to him. So the prophecy indicates that Christ will have gone to his garden to gather certain lilies. And this is likely referring to select individuals who will be given nourishment. Nourishment in the spiritual sense, in the wilderness, in the field, in a place of safety. And so the evidence suggests that the place of safety is where Christ is going to fulfill his earthly ministry, the second half of the week. Let's go over to Galatians and chapter 1. This is something that should be pointed out, and it is pointed out in our booklet. Again, if you doubt any of these things and that I've mentioned in this series of sermons, there is more information given in our booklet on the subject regarding the place of safety. There are things mentioned in these sermons that are not mentioned in the booklet, so I think I wanted to give these as a kind of a companion to that booklet, and it is something that many people have not thought about or considered. And so some questions have come up in recent months, and it is something that we could cover again and again. Many have thought that the Apostle Paul was taken to Arabia, where he was taught by Christ in this area for 3 years. Now, if that were the case, then it would be possible for Paul's education to be included in Christ's earthly ministry, and perhaps it would even qualify as the second half of Christ's earthly ministry. However, an examination, if we look at what Paul said, we see that Paul indicated that Christ actually did not personally teach him over a period of 3 years in Arabia. He did not have, that is, hands-on instruction by Christ during that time. So notice that Paul, he began to preach the Messiah right away after his vision was restored. And that's found in the book of Acts chapter 9 in verses 19 through 22. Right away he began to preach Christ as the Savior. And that was before he went to Arabia. Now, also, when we look at the wording, the phrasing, Paul actually never said that he spent the entire 3 years in Arabia. He actually said he went to Arabia and then he went to Damascus, which is quite a distance from Arabia. And so the time that he spent in both of those locations is a period of 3 years. Look at this in Galatians 1 and verse 15. When it pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son to me, that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately confer with flesh and blood, nor did I go to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went to Arabia and returned again to Damascus. And so he puts the two together. So Paul must have either spent, you know, a fair portion in Damascus, or, you know, the 3 years had to include both of these locations. And Paul also said something else that's worth noting in this same chapter, is that Paul taught the gospel, as he said, by revelation from God. And he speaks of learning those things from Christ, through the Holy Spirit. Of course, that Spirit comes directly from God. Galatians 1 and verse 12, he said, I neither received it from man. Well, let's just go ahead and read verse 11. I make known to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ. And something that might be worth having in your side notes next to this verse is Ephesians 3. Ephesians 3, and I have it in my notes, you don't have to turn there. In verses 2 through 5, I'm going to summarize it. By revelation, Paul said, by revelation, he, meaning Christ, made known to me the mystery, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it now has been revealed. How is it revealed? He said, by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets, through the revelation of God's Spirit. And if you'd look again here, the same page you're probably on, chapter 2, Galatians 2, and verses 1 and 2, Paul said, after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas and also took Titus with me, and I went up by revelation and communicated to them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to those who were of reputation, lest by any means I might run or had run in vain. So again, he's talking about the revelation, the understanding of the truth and the scriptures, putting pieces of the prophetic puzzle together through God's Holy Spirit, the same type of things that you and I do when we have God's Spirit and we search the scriptures for truth and begin to understand how many of the scriptures relate to one another. And so Paul did not say, he never actually said that he was taught personally by Christ in person for 3 years. And therefore, the period of time that Paul may have spent in Arabia and also Damascus, I do not believe that could have fulfilled Christ's 7-year ministry, the period of time that is spoken of by the prophet Daniel. And so, if we think, we keep that in mind, any fulfillment of Christ's ministry, if it is 7 years, as it seems to indicate, the prophecy indicates, but it was stopped in the middle of the week, the fulfillment is yet to come. It hasn't happened yet. And something of such significance, of course, would be mentioned in the scriptures, wouldn't it? All the prophecies that are mentioned, wouldn't that be mentioned? The fulfillment of Christ's ministry? Well, we believe that it is mentioned. It is mentioned within the prophecies of the woman being taken to a place of nourishment and Christ coming and going to the same place, his garden, where he also partakes of spiritual fruit. It's the time, times, and half a time. Ezekiel in chapter 5. It is common throughout the wider Church of God to assume that as long as you're a part of the body, as long as you keep the Sabbath and attend the holy days, as long as you give an offering during the times that we should, as long as we tithe, that we're in. We will be a part of the better resurrection. Now, in the eternal Church of God, we're one of the few groups out there that have stressed the fact that being a part of the Church of God does not guarantee anything. Being called and being chosen, it's a good thing to be a part of the church. Don't get me wrong. I don't want you to underestimate it. But being called and being chosen are actually two different things. Christ clearly indicated that when he said many are called, but few are chosen. And yet a lot of people don't get it. So calling, that begins the process. It begins the process of conversion. And a person is only chosen after they prove themselves to be faithful. Paul talked about being disqualified, that it was possible, he thought, it's possible I could be disqualified, Paul said of himself. So in other words, there needs to be a qualification in order to be chosen. And the same situation applies to those who might be taken to a place of protection. Consider this scenario, if you will. We had talked last week about children, young children, or people that are dependent upon their converted parent or parents, that they would likely be taken with their parents to a place of protection. But even though the young, that whether physically or perhaps young spiritually immature, even though they might share some of those experiences in the wilderness, it doesn't mean that those people are going to be included as a part of the better resurrection. In other words, it doesn't mean that they are going to be chosen. There's a process of conversion. There's a process of being tested. Having, you know, James said, count it all joy when you experience various trials or temptations, as he says. Because that's a part of the process. We have to go through that. That is where we developed the gold, where we purchased the gold tried in fire. And so people need to be converted, they need to be tested, they need to be proven to be faithful. This is the qualification process. Now, a level of perfection, which is spiritual maturity, which when Christ said, be you therefore perfect, he wasn't talking about being flawless, he was talking about having a degree of spiritual maturity, that can be reached in this life. And that is how we qualify to be chosen. And so the same scenario for children in a place of safety would be for adults, people that are immature spiritually, or perhaps haven't reached that point where God says, now I know. I'm fully confident in them now. Not all those who are found, this is the point, not all those who are found worthy to escape those things to come will be chosen. And just because we may have some knowledge, just because we might be included with those people who will be taken, does not mean that our fate is sealed as a person who will become a king and a priest. Now, an example can be derived from a prophecy that God gave to Ezekiel. Ezekiel was instructed to perform an acted oracle. He performed several acted oracles, all very interesting. And this one would also be a display to people of what would become of Jerusalem. But not Jerusalem alone, because like all acted oracles, there is a duality. God, I can't think of one. There might be one, but I can't think of a single prophecy that it doesn't have a dual purpose. God does this consistently throughout the scriptures. Like so many prophecies of God, this acted oracle is dual. And I want to read it in Ezekiel 5 and the first four verses here, where it says, "And you, son of man, take a sharp sword, take it as a barber's razor, and pass it over your head and your beard." In other words, shave, take off all your hair. "Then take scales to weigh and divide the hair." And then after he has divided it into these portions, here's what you shall do with it. He goes on to say, "You shall burn with fire one third in the midst of the city when these days of siege are finished. And you shall take one third and strike it around with the sword. And one third you shall scatter in the wind. And I will draw out a sword after them." Why thirds? Well, it's interesting that there are many thirds that are mentioned in the book of Revelation in regards to what will occur during that time. It goes on to say, "You shall also take a small number of them." So out of those thirds, you take a small number, a very small number, and bind them in the edge of your garment. In other words, keep them safe. Keep them apart from the rest. "Then take some of them again." Now, of that number, an even smaller amount, "take some of them again and throw them into the midst of the fire and burn them in the fire. From there a fire will go out into all the house of Israel." And he concludes here saying, "This says the Eternal God, this is Jerusalem. I have set her in the midst of the nations and the countries all around her." Now remember this. This is something that's good to note. That Ezekiel, he was taken captive with Judah 120 years after the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, had already fallen to the Assyrians. And so Jerusalem at this time likely had already fallen when Ezekiel was told to do this among the people. And therefore, it must include something that is yet to come, something that has not yet been fulfilled. Now, it may include the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That would have taken place, you know, centuries after Ezekiel had already died. But I think that Ezekiel was told this fire would go out where? Into all the house of Israel. But the house of Israel was already taken. They were already gone and being scattered among the nations. And so I believe the prophecy is honing in on the descendants of Israel, the people that carry Jacob's name. And remember what Jacob said to the blessing he gave to Joseph's sons. "Let my name be on them, Ephraim and Manasseh." The Great Tribulation, a time, it says, of Jacob's trouble. The house of Israel, and likely including the other descendants as well, Reuben, Gad, Naphtali, all of them, that are all scattered around the world at this time, living among the nations. They don't even know who they are, most of them are, don't. And so it's my conclusion that this must reflect the Great Tribulation that is coming. Many will perish during that time. Remember the thirds that are mentioned in the book of Revelation. Some in flames, some will flee while armies pursue them and destroy them, as is portrayed by the sword dashing them. A third will go into captivity, and a small number will be kept safe, portrayed by Ezekiel taking a bit of his hair and putting it in his garment, sewing it into a little hem of his garment. But of that number, a small amount is taken out and cast into the fire. Why? Why does that happen? Well, could it be that some who may have found worthy, may have been found worthy to escape Great Tribulation and go to this place, that perhaps they will not hold their value while being nourished in the wilderness? Could they be removed from that place and put into the tribulation? I think that is what Ezekiel is portraying here, this acted oracle. And so think about this for a moment. The place of safety, it will be wonderful to be there. I hope that we are there. I hope you're there and you're there and you're there. And of course, I hope I get to be there. But think about this. It's not going to be a cakewalk. This is not going to be some resort where it's just, let's just soak up the sunshine and feast and we're all warm and cozy and everything is great. It's called a wilderness. And our wilderness is defined as a large tract of land that has not been significantly affected by human development. So I don't think there are going to be houses there. I don't think there's going to be running water, or at least the kind like we're used to, coming out of a faucet. Maybe those things could be built in that place. I don't know. But it'll be people will be taken care of. I think there will be clean, fresh water. I think that food will be provided for people. But if anyone has ever gone camping for more than a few days, I used to go backpacking in my younger years. I don't know if I could do it anymore. But it was rough. We'd spend usually at least a minimum of a week in the high country. And just, you know, we'd have to take a lot with us, provisions and what have you. And we would live off the land to a degree. Water and fish and what have you. But it was rough. I enjoyed it. But it was tough. Imagine doing that for 3 years. That'll be rough. And on top of that, you know, there's going to be a lot of challenges, not just physically, but emotionally, relationship-wise. You know, maybe some people won't get along. We don't really know. But considering what happens in our relationships now, is it really going to be that much different in a place of safety? I hope it will, but look what happened to Israel. Look at the example of them. We would think, oh, things are going to be different. You come out of Egypt now and look at the miracles and all these things and God providing manna. Oh, we're all going to have a great attitude now. No, that isn't how it went. Everybody didn't have a great attitude. It didn't go well for many people. So it's likely something like that will happen again. I mean, it's called a garden, but it's also called a wilderness. So it's not going to be paradise. Don't get your hopes up for that. The hope is found in what will happen in that place. The conversation that will be had in that place. The interaction with other believers. Kindred spirits, if you will. And of course, most importantly, the conversation and the interaction that we would be able to have with Jesus Christ in the flesh. That is inspiration enough to be as faithful as we can, to be found worthy to escape those things that are coming. So we don't know how exactly it's going to play out for everyone, but I think Ezekiel indicated in his acted oracle that for some it is not going to go well, at least toward the end. Let's go back to Revelation 3 to conclude. We are living in the last era of the New Testament. And there is, of course, a measure of Laodicea within the wider Church of God. I believe it is a larger measure of Laodicea than what also is found a measure of Philadelphia. I think my personal belief is that there's a little Laodicea in all of us. And if somebody says, no, not me, that's a sign that, well, yes, that does include you as well. So this element of Philadelphia exists alongside of Laodicea. And that is what I want to focus on because it is something to reach for. It is something that you and I can be a part of. The era of Philadelphia. We live during that time as well. So Christ speaks to these people with great encouragement in Revelation 3 and verse 10. He says, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one take your crown. So to those people who think it's a done deal, the crown's just waiting there for you, just waiting for you to pick it up. It's possible that it can be taken. It can be given to somebody else. We have to endure to the end. So our fate is not sealed. Even those who may have reached a level of perfection are told in this letter to Philadelphia that they have to endure. But this is good news. Don't consider it something that's like, oh, grief. No, this is really good news. This is wonderful for us to know because if we strive to live by every word of God, He promises to keep us from great tribulation. This is an inseparable facet of the gospel of the kingdom of God, because even better than being found worthy to escape the horrific plagues that will come at the end of the age. Verse 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. No, a permanent fixture in God's house. I will write on him the name of my God, the family name of God, the name of the city of my God, New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. In other words, you're not going to be known by Mia anymore, or Michelle, or Ardith, or Terry. No, a new name, because that new creation that has started in us through God's Spirit will be born one day, and we will have a new name. Be born into the family of God, because we will have also his name. Verse 13, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.